Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hi, I'm Ross Kemp. Over the last 18 years, I've made some 90-odd documentaries predominantly in hostile environments, from Afghanistan to Syria, from El Salvador to the Congo. And it's fair to say that during that time, I found myself in a few interesting situations. I've been shot at, tear-gassed, had knives pulled on me, and spears thrown at me. But in all those years, what's impressed me the most is the resilience of the human spirit. Our ability, no matter where we're from, to overcome and make it through to the other side. So, in my new series, The Kemp Cast, I'll be talking to some incredible individuals who all have engaging stories to tell and have themselves overcome some extremely tough moments in their lives. Right now, we're living in unprecedented times, and we should be doing all we can together to get through this as safely as possible. I hope that if you subscribe to the Kempcast and hear how my guests overcame their toughest moments, it may help you overcome yours, whether you're going through one right now or you're faced with one in the future. Joining me today is the one and only Ricky the Hitman Hatton, MBE. During his successful boxing career, he held four separate world titles and is truly one of the most popular British boxers, if not sportsmen, of all time. I hope you enjoy the show. Ricky, thanks for agreeing to talk to us, mate.
No, pleasure.
How have you found lockdown, mate?
To be honest with you, I was a little bit worried when it first came about because I know people know the story on me. I've suffered a little bit with my mental health, you know, in the past few years, and I live on my own now. And but when it first came about, I think, like all of us, I think we was a little bit weary. Oh, where's this going to end up, you know, and all that. And I think the first couple of weeks, I didn't take it too well. I was sat in the house, I was filling my face with food and having a bit of a drink and all that. And I thought, Rick, if this is going to last 2 or 3 months or whatever it's going to last, you can't carry on like this, mate. You know, you work so hard to get your life back in that on track and in the position it was. Don't start, you know, going down the same road. And I just looked at it as a training camp, because when I used to fight, I used to do 12 weeks training camp where I'd diet, I'd train every day, I'd have no, I wouldn't have a drink, you know, I wouldn't see my family, I wouldn't see my mates. And so the lockdown wasn't as extreme as a training camp. Do you know what I mean? You know, I still have my kids able to come round, my girls able to come round and see me. And once I got that fact training camp mentality in my brain, I think it's, I can't say I've enjoyed it, but it's done me the world of good, to be honest. I lost a little bit of weight, you know, I'm feeling good and healthier, better in myself. I think I've done about a stone and a half in. So to use a bad thing to my advantage, yeah.
But that has been something that you have had to do all the way through, well, through your boxing career, wasn't it? You say, I've just done a stone and a half. For most people, they'd be, you know, Weight Watchers Lady or Man of the Year if they could just lose a stone and a half that quickly. Do you think you've perfected the art of losing weight quickly?
Yeah, well, I mean, there has been a lot of fighters in history that, you know, have had to lose a load of weight, you know, and I was known as Ricky Fatten once.
By some who were brave enough to shout it from 100 miles away, yeah.
You know, I don't think I helped myself, but, you know, everyone knew I'd eat and I'd put weight on and I'd have a little pint of Guinness and that, and people used to, I mean, that's, but people could relate to me, you know, because of that. I mean, if I was, I'm a boxing trainer now, and, You know, if any of my boxers wanted to put weight on to the extent like I used to do, they'd get a clip round the ear, to be honest with you. It's a simple case of, you know, do as I say, but not as I did, you know. And yeah, I was sort of like famous for putting weight on, and although I wouldn't advise it, because I think if I'd looked after myself a little bit better, my career might have been able to go on for a few more years extra, because, I mean, you can't burn the candle at both ends and get away with it for forever. But I think because being the little scallywag I was, and the Jack the Lad, I think that's where the fan base come from. So if you're saying to me, would I change it? Probably not, you know.
No, and we'll go on to the size of that fan base, but that is something that you've got on the record as saying, you know, I think you've been a 4 times world champion at different weights, but you're more proud of the fact that, you know, you have that fan base, that 40,000 people will travel across the pond to see your box, that 58,000 will fill a sports arena. I mean, you know, I watched some of those scenes last night. I was looking at some of the old fights, and I mean, it was Hatton mania, wasn't it?
It was fairy tale stuff, to be honest with you. You know, the crowds, you know, when the first time I went to Vegas, there was, I think there was like 5,000 went to the Paris Hotel. And then for the Castillo fight, there was 10,000. Then for Mayweather, there was 35,000. And then for Pacquiao, there was like 20,000. And I think, you know, we mentioned the Frank Bruno before there, Ross, you know, was one of our favourites, one of our, you know, very proud to call him a mate now. But, you know, I mean, when he boxed Mike Tyson in Las Vegas, he had the record number of fans going over to watch, and it was 10,000. And when I fought Mayweather, you know, 35,000. I mean, this is like more fans than my heroes and the people I grew up aspiring to be. You know what I mean? It doesn't happen, you know, like 58,000 at the City of Manchester Stadium for my comeback fight after Mayweather was sold out in a fortnight. In 2 weeks, you know, it's like, it's just some stuff that I'll never, ever, you know, I still pinch myself and having to believe it, you know, the fan base that I had. And when you think, you know, if, you know, I'm when I boxed in Vegas, I was like tripling the amount of fans our Frank took there. How can that not be your best ever achievement? You know, it makes me feel proud when I go to the pub or I walk down the street and people still talk about the big fights and the fights in Vegas. It makes me feel proud knowing how many people have such enjoyment have brought to people, you know, yeah.
But you were, you were an awesome fighter, mate. And let's not put that aside. You may be a man of the people, and that is often rare because the attention that you get is overwhelming as a fighter. I would like to talk to you about the psychology of that. You know, if you're playing in a World Cup final as a footballer and you lose, you can turn to 10 of those other blokes and say, well, if only you'd squared the ball at that point, or do you know what? If you hadn't tackled him there, we wouldn't have given the penalty away. There's ways that you can offload excuses as to why you fail. There are very few people that you can turn to as a fighter, particularly when you lose. And it's also incredibly public, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's like, you know, with football, you know, you've got them 10 teammates on the pitch, a matter of yards away from you. And the thing is with boxing is like, you know, you have your trainer that will give you the advice and that minute rest in the corner. But then, you know, when he puts the gum shield back in, it's like the referee blowing the whistle. When you put the gum shield back in, it's like you get out on the pitch on your own there. You know what I mean? And it's not, you're not having a nudge or an elbow or a kick on the ankle. You're getting bones broke, you know. So it's, and I think you've got to have massive, to be a boxer, I mean, to do for a living, to get punched in the face. I mean, you've got to have, you've got to be a rare breed anyway upstairs to want to do that for a living. But I think you've got to have huge, huge, massive self-belief. And I think it's the biggest thing that you can take into boxing. I mean, you've got to have, there's all things you've got to take into consideration. You've got to have the chin, you've got to have the stamina, you've got to have the, you know, the knowledge, the game plan. But the one thing is, because, I mean, you can't turn out there and be brilliant every night. Some nights, you know, it's going to go wrong and it's going to go a bit tits up, you know, and, you know, sometimes when that's happening, it's only you can drag yourself through it. You know, your trainer can give you that advice in that minute of the round, but it's only you. You've got the one that's got to do it. You've got to take the advice on the board and then go out and do it on your own. And that's the, I think that's why boxers are so probably respected, because I think, you know, when you see the fights in Vegas, you see all the footballers, go watching it. You see all the film stars going watching it, you know, because I think most people say, you know what, I could do acting for a living, or I could do cricket, or I could do football, but could I do that game? Probably not. And I think that's why we're holding boxers held in such high regard, and rightly so. But it's ultimately you've got to have massive self-belief, you know, when the pressure's on and there's only you and that man across the ring, that's when you've got to have the huge belief in yourself. And I was very fortunate, you know, I wasn't blessed with the talent of most, but I was blessed with heart, desire, determination, and a massive self-belief, even when people didn't think I could, you know.
Where does that self-belief come from?
I don't know. I think it's something you must be born with. You know what I mean? It's your confidence builds is with each win, and as your career progresses, you go from 4 round to 6 round and 8 round, and the people you beat, so your confidence goes up. But I think it can only be, you know, I was from a very young age, from 18 years of age. You know, when people used to interview me, they used to, you know, and I've never been an arrogant person. I mean, that's why people like me. But from a very young age, they went, "What are you going to be?" Oh, I said, "The best in the world." They went, "Oh, world champion." I went, no, the best in my weight, the best in the world. And they used to think, "Who's this cocky little shit?" But
you weren't that cocky. You were just determined, weren't you? That was that self-belief coming out.
I always had self-belief. And I used to read, you know, the reporters, they used to turn around and say, "Well, he sells a lot of tickets and he's very exciting, but he gets caught and he gets hit with the right hand too often and his defence is a little bit leaky." And I just, it sort of like worked for me. And that was my fuel to go out and prove people wrong, because I used to think, am I seeing something they're not? Or am I just kidding myself of, you know, what I've been? But it's like that, having that self-belief in yourself. It doesn't matter listening what people do, that tunnel vision, that's what I'm going to achieve, that's what I want to do. I was able to do it, and it's because of that I was able to meet people that ultimately had more talent than me. Do you know what I mean? But because I had self-belief and I worked hard and I trained hard and I wanted it a little bit more, and I was able to meet people that had more talent than me. And I think that's what people loved about me. You know, some fights I didn't win because I wore my heart on my sleeve and I put my foot down and got stuck in. And I think that's why people like me, you know.
Just talk to me then for... You know, I was a London schoolboy when I was a kid, right? I know that horrible feeling of having, when he doesn't grip your hand, then he lifts the other guy's hand, you're waiting for that ref to lift that hand up. You went through all that and you were incredibly good at it, but you know at one point you got cheated, don't you?
Yeah.
What did that mean to you when you found out that even though you'd won that fight and it was an international level, wasn't it, but still amateur?
Yeah.
What did that mean? What did that tell you about the fight game at that point?
Well, it's, you know, to be honest with you, my amateur coach, who's passed away now, sadly, Mr. Paul Dunn, God rest his soul, he used to say to me, and I was devastated because, you know, even though I was only 17 years of age and it was in the World Junior Championships in Havana, Cuba.
Quarterfinals? Was it quarterfinals?
Yeah, quarterfinals. No, semifinals, actually. I beat a Georgian, and then I beat the Cuban, and in fact, I'm the only British fighter to beat a Cuban in Cuba presently to this date. You know, I mean, I beat the favourite, beat the Cuban, and just how good the Cubans were, they won every weight division except two, mine and the one above, you know. So,
correct me if I'm wrong, they weren't allowed to fight professionally, so they're amateurs with their professionals.
But they were like professionals, and even in the World Juniors, only 17 years of age, they were like just a different breed, and to fight one in Cuba. So anyway, I beat the Cuban, then I beat the American, and I was matched against a Russian, and I won the fight quite comfortably. I fought, and I thought, oh, in the final here, and they raised the other one's hand, and in fairness, all the Cubans, they all stood up in the crowd and all started booing and everything like that. So I was devastated. But my trainer Paul Dunn told me something, and I tell my lads now, I say, listen, you know, you can't be brilliant every night. You can't win every single fight. You're going to have little bumps along the way. But it's not where you start in this game. It's where you finish. He said, as long as you get beat, you know what I mean? As long as you can move on and tap from it, you know. And there's so many fighters like that. We keep referring to our Frank, don't we? But I mean, how many times did Frank fight for the world title and he didn't get it? He got knocked out and he come back and he got knocked out. He got there in the end. And that's the type of, you know, attitude you've got to have. And I was told that from my first, which that was ultimately my first disappointment, Ross, where I thought my world had come to an end. I thought, you know, I was going to be a world champion. And then all of a sudden, it wasn't. I thought it was, I couldn't have felt any worse. And But the right words said at the right time by my trainer, and that mentality has stayed with me till present day, I think.
And that all wraps into that self-belief. The lovely thing I love, this is just great, about your professional career, and it tickled me. Your first fight, I think, was in Hale, in a leisure centre, the Kingston Leisure Centre. And then your second match was in Madison Square Gardens. Yeah. Does that sum up boxing?
It does, yeah, to be honest.
Hale Leisure Centre 1 week, next week, Madison Square Gardens.
Yeah, and I was very fortunate that I won about 8 national amateur titles. So when Frank Warren signed me, you know, he was he had obviously high hopes for me. And I made my professional debut, which I impressed. And then he said, you're going to box at Madison Square Garden, you know, on the Nassim Hamed versus Kevin Kelly undercard. And I thought, wow, because I was always a boxing historian, right, from being a youngster and a teenager. I always watched all the fight videos of all the great champions and all the fighters of old. And then all of a sudden they said Madison Square Garden. I thought, oh, you're joking. And it was like, it was incredible. It was incredible. I mean, there was one, you know, I was doing a four rounder. I was on one of the first fights of the night, and the ring announcer was Michael Buffer. You know, let's get ready to rumble.
Rumble.
Yeah, was doing, you know, he was the ring announcer. You know, for me four rounders, and I thought, oh my God, it's Michael Buffer. And George Foreman sat at ringside commentating for HBO, and you know, it's like, 1 minute, like we said earlier, 1 minute you're boxing in working men's club in and around Manchester, and then the next, you know, few months after, you're boxing at Madison Square Garden. And, you know, it was brilliant. I put in a great performance. Everybody was talking about me, even back then at our young age. And then I come back to ringside to watch the main event, Nassim Hamed and Kevin Kelly. And it's like, it was like Robert De Niro and Al Pacino, just like seats away from you. I thought, oh my God, I thought I've made it already. If I retire now, I'll be happy. It was brilliant. And these that was like only 2 fights in, you know. And I mean, you know, September 11th is also remembered for the sort of tragedies which happened in New York. But September 11th was also my debut, and it was Friday just gone, obviously September 11th, and 23 years ago that
pub. Did you ever think in your wildest dreams, and it sounds like you did, that you were going to have the career that you've had?
I always believed that I could do you know what I mean? And I was training in a gym in Manchester called the Phoenix Camp. It was in Salford in Manchester. And there was loads of British champions, Commonwealth champions, European champions, and even world champion at the time, Carl Thompson, who was in them brilliant wars in Manchester with Chris Eubank years ago. Well, I shared a gym with all these guys, Ensley Bingham, who was the British champion, Steve the Viking Foster, who was Commonwealth champion, Andy Holligan was European champion and British champion, all these champions in the gym. And I was just a little whippersnapper at 16 that when I first went down to train with him. And all these people, all these champions were telling me I was going to be world champion. And so I think to myself, if these people are telling me, I must have half a chance. So I did have confidence in myself, a huge self-belief that I was going to get there. But even so, there's always like just with a pinch of salt, don't you? You say them things with a pinch of salt, but you never really believe that they... Even though you're confident enough, you know, to achieve it to the state I did achieve it at, you know, I mean, you know, record crowds going over to Vegas, you know, and 58,000 at the City of Manchester Stadium, and fighting the, and as it turned out, not just the best fighters in my weight division, I became the best in my weight division and 2 weights, but meeting, you know, fighting people like who go down as 2 of the greatest in history, you know, you think of Mayweather and Pacquiao. We're going to go down as the greatest in history. And until I made my comeback, those were the only 2 that beat me. So as hard as it was to accept, I can't have too many complaints, mate, can I? You know, so.
Not really. But I want to come to that in a minute. Talk me through. You're in that dressing room before that fight, yeah? Whether it's the MGM Grand, whether it's before you go out, that's what's now the Emirates, wherever it is, yeah? What's going through your mind those last minutes? Or even, you know, as the dressing gown comes on, and you walk through that crowd. How much pressure is on you at that point? Is it about you winning? Is it about winning for them? What is it about at that moment?
People say what's one of the hardest things about you, you know, and I found the most difficult fight time of my fight was when the TV people, you know, stick their head in the changing room door and go, right, Ricky, let's go. And it's like, that's when you've got to hold your nerves together. The more, you know, reality hits in, then you think, oh, because you're in the change room, you're warming up, and you think it's never going to come. And then all of a sudden, when they stick their head on the door, Rick, let's go, you think, oh, shit, it's here now. So, and that's when you've got to hold yourself together. And I always try and think to myself, because you've got, you know, the fights used to be on Sky Sports, live on HBO or Showtime. You've got thousands of people, you know, in the arena watching it. And then, you've been working on your game plan with your trainer for like 12 weeks. And that's when you think, when the pressure's on, when the crowd's roaring and your bottle's going, that's when you've got to hold your nerves together and try and remember that game plan. And as I'm walking to the rings, you start breathing a little bit heavier and you just think, I used to just think to myself, just remember the game plan. Remember the game plan. It's essential that we get off to a good start and we get that game plan set in motion right from the first bell. If you get off to a good start, then obviously everything snowballs then. You know, you fall into a little bit more of a rhythm sooner than you normally would. And it's, you know, just hold your nerves together. And I think that's what, the good champions are always very fortunate to do, was to hold it together at that moment when you're expected to crumble. And it's that's the difference. And it's when you get to the very top, it's all fine lines, narrow margins. It's fine lines which make all the difference. And it's someone that can just hold it through together. And as I was walking to the ring, I always used to think to myself, just think how hard you've trained, Ricky, the sacrifices you've done, not seeing your family, not seeing your kids, not seeing your friends and your mates, you know, running every morning, dieting, you've lost 3 stone in weight again, you fat little sod, you know what I mean? Look what he's made you go through to get to here. And if he beats you, he's taking money out of your kid's mouth. That's what I used to
do
in order to psych myself up, to get myself in a frenzy. And it's one thing psyching yourself up like that, you can imagine that would psych yourself up, but it's also, you know, that controlled aggression. You've got to psych yourself up, but also keep your nerve and keep your cool. And
have you ever over-adrenalized? Have you ever got to the point where there was so much pumping through you, it locked you up, you weren't flowing?
I did one time, I think, when I fought Floyd Mayweather. And he, you know, let's have it right, he can annoy you up, him, can't he, Mayweather, to be honest with you. He can get under your skin a bit, can't he? But I remember when I went to the weigh-in, and I think it did put him off a little bit, because I think he could see there was no fear. You know, we had like, 10,000 British fans at the weigh-in, you know, and it was, he got in my face, and then I got in his, and there was a bit of pushing and shoving, and I got the mic, and I found the rest of the crowd. And I think he must have thought, God, this fella's come to fight, you know. When you can tell when someone believes that they're not just coming here to make the numbers up. And I think when he saw me at the weigh-in, but I was acting a little bit out of character, you know. I looked at him and he was winding me up, and I went to give him that sign, you know, which is something I've never ever done in my life. And I think to myself, maybe he did get a little bit under me skin a little bit, you know, and maybe at the weigh-in I overreacted a little bit more than what I got a little bit giddy. But when the bell went for the first round, you know, Billy said, ease into it. And I eased into it, and he hit me left hook. Didn't even see it was that fast. And I said to Billy at the end of the first round, I said, I can't stand off this fella. I said, I've got to use what my strengths are, which is punch volume, aggression, work rate, and stay on top of him and try and throw more punches than him. And it was working for a short bit, but, you know, so... But I never got myself. I got wound up at the weigh-in, and then when I went back to the hotel room, and when you went a bit giddy there, it settled yourself down here. We can't take that into the ring tomorrow. And then when I went into when the fight came the following day, I cooled myself down. And I think that was one when the adrenaline got the better of me. It was at the Mayweather weigh-in. Yeah, absolutely.
People who are outside the fight game often perceive that kind of aggression that's seen at a weigh-in is manufactured by promoters, by the TV. That's not always the case, is it?
Definitely not with me, you know, and I think that's why I keep, you know, people like me. We did the 24/7 programme with Mayweather, where we had to go all over America, all over Britain, London, Manchester, Michigan, Las Vegas, Los Angeles, and I was with him about 2 weeks. And I come back to Manchester, and I was like, I was doing my stand-up comedy version. I was telling the one-liners and taking the mickey out of him. And that's when I really did get under his skin. I think Oscar De La Hoya told me, Mayweather's on the train going back to London here. He's doing cartwheels. He said, because you wound him up. And that's just my and I can't, it's our character for me to get nasty like I did at the Mayweather weigh-in. My character is to have a tell a joke and a one-liner and try and get under the skin, but in with humour. And I think that worked a little bit in the 24/7, but it was it was a great experience. I mean, ultimately, I got beat by Mayweather, but, you know, when you look back now, probably with the fans that went over, and, you know, and with him being the man he is, probably the best of all time there's ever been. You know, to when I look back at that, and I like to think Floyd would probably admit, when you think of, because the fans were there, the atmosphere, the difference in personalities between me and him, and the difference in styles and that. I've never been to Vegas, and I've been to Vegas to watch everyone. I've never experienced an atmosphere than it was when me and Floyd went. And I think it'd be, even when I went to watch Floyd and Pacquiao fight, I don't think it captivated the same excitement as mine did that weekend. And even though it ended up in defeat, still one of the proudest moments of my life.
And rightly so, sir. And not many more, as you know, not many, very, very few on this planet could ever have achieved such heights. When you're in the ring, what are you seeing? I mean, are you looking for combinations? Are you going, oh, he's laying off now, I can go under him?
Well, the main thing is, I think he's just getting off to a good start. You know what I mean? And you know, I mean, and what you want to do, you know, because, you know, you want to, whatever the tactics you've been discussing, if that first bell comes, you know, and Billy says, when he does this, when he does that, do this, do that, and it starts coming off, you warm into the fight then, your confidence goes up because, you know, everything we've been working on is working now. But then sometimes, you know, everything you've had a game plan in your mind, and then all of a sudden you try it and it don't come off. And then then as a fighter, you've got to think, right, plan B here now. I need a second game plan here now. You know, what am I gonna do here in order to alter it? Like the Mayweather fight, because I thought I'd ease into it, and there was, if I ease into it, it'd absolutely pick me off.
Well, but what you are well famous for historically, and will always will be, is one of the best body punchers that's ever existed, and that's the game, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And to be honest with you, I thought the referee gave Floyd a little bit of help. I mean, people probably sound like Ricky sounds like a broken record when he says that. But Floyd didn't need any help. He was very good at looking after his body, because, you know, if he had that shoulder roll technique where he'd cross his arms over his body, he'd pick the body shot off there, pick the body shot up there, he'd roll the right hand and catch a left hook. He was, even though traditionally he was known as a more of a distance fighter, he was very good up close, you know what I mean? And
it was hard to hit the target, yeah?
He was very hard to hit the target, yeah. And one of my best things with my body punches, you know, I could find that target. I could put it on a one-pence piece, mate, that target. But with Floyd, because he was so good defensively, you know, there was times when I used to come back to my corner and you know, and even after the fight, when I went back to the change rooms after, you know, where even though I thought the referee might have been doing him a few more favours, I come back to the change room. It's the first time in all my fights where I thought, wow, he was good. You know what I mean? Just, you know, so many punches were just glancing off him, you know, and I was famous for my accuracy, especially to the body, you know, and for him to deflect so many shots and just make them miss and slide and get an half block on one, it was really, 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 really something. Yeah, and, you know, probably go down as one of the greatest of all time, if not, you know, the best actual boxer for, you know, for technique and ability and everything. I don't think there's many better than him.
There's not many as arrogant as him, but he can afford to be, can't he? And you know what? I tell you a story about him. We were filming in Vegas doing a story about people living in the tunnels, you know, people who come there for the weekend. And we were loading we're outside the MGM Grand, putting the cameraman was putting the cameras on, and he wandered out and just asked what we were doing. And there was no flash. There was no arrogance. He was on his own. And we just went, oh, that was Floyd Mayweather. Was that Floyd Mayweather, you know, the guy that was helping us load the vehicle? Oh, yeah, that's Floyd Mayweather. So, you know, maybe some of that's part and parcel of that salesman, that technique that you have to be, draw the crowds in. I don't know.
Of course it is. No, listen, we're all built differently. And I think to myself, you know, that a prime example is Tyson Fury. Some of the stuff Tyson Fury comes out in his interviews and stuff like that, you know, as his mate, I think, oh, Tyson, shut up. But, you know, that's Tyson, you know what I mean? But when you see some of the things over the years, he's done interviews, Tyson, where he's said this and he's upset someone and he's upset that, you know what I mean? But that's Tyson. You know, when you see the real man, which I'm very proud to say I know, he's nothing like that. People are starting to see, because he's got over his mental problems, he's had a lot of difficulties over the years as well, Tyson. People are starting to see the real, real Tyson now, not the person that, you know, the minute this microphone comes up and he's performing and he's kicking off and he's pushing and shoving and calling everyone. And, you know, I think that's the same. You've got to sell yourself, haven't you? You know what I mean? And
no one else is trying
it. I'm talking about the boxer Floyd Mayweather, you know, the person on the camera with the interviews. I don't know him publicly, so he's probably one of us. He's probably sound as a pound.
Did you ever see him afterwards?
Not really. I saw him after at the press conference, and he was giving me lots of praise. You know, he was saying, "No, Ricky," he said, "you know, I'm glad I got you when I did," because he said, "you know, if I hadn't knocked you out," I said, "you'd have been there all night." You know, he said, "you kept coming," and he said, "I kept going to my corner," and he said, "you know, his trainer Roger Mayweather, who's passed away now, God rest his soul." He used to say to him, he said, "don't worry, you've done him now, you've got him now, this next round you take him out." He said, "and you come out even faster." He said, "you know, fair play to you." And that's what he was. And even when the fight was running away from me, you know, towards the latter end of the fight, you know what I mean, I still kept going at him, still kept going at him, where most would probably say, "tonight's not my night, I'll just jab and move and keep out of the way, live to fight another day." No, for as long as I was in there, I always tried to knock him out. And I think that's what he respected me for in a roundabout way.
But that does define you, doesn't it? Again, that self-belief. A lot of your fights have gone all the way, nearly all the way, haven't they? I mean, that also takes such energy. I mean, for people who have done it, it's hard enough doing it for three 3-minute rounds, doing it for 12. And also, it's not just try holding your hands up and jumping up and down on the spot for 3 minutes. That alone, having someone chasing you around that potentially could take you out.
Yeah, well, the thing is with boxing and what people always, they say it's the hardest game in the world, but generally what people see on the TV is just the fight, isn't it? You know, 12 3-minute rounds on the fight, and they go, "God, that's a tough game." But they've not seen the 12 weeks leading up to it, you know, when you first start going and you first getting your weight off, and then you've got a diet, and then you know your trips to the pub, they've got to be knocked on the head, and, you know, you get up in the morning, you go running, you come home, you have your breakfast, you train, you come home, have your tea, you watch a bit of TV, you go to bed, and you do the same every day. And then as the fight gets nearer, you know, your miles, your road work, the mileage gets upped, and then you're sparring, the rounds gets upped, you know what I mean? Like a month before, you do like 12 rounds sparring practically, you know, every day, dieting and all that. And then once you've done all that and made the weights and everything, then you've got the small matter of the fight.
What do you think about Mike Tyson coming out of retirement?
You know, I'm very fortunate that I've met Mike on several occasions, to be honest with you. And several occasions that I have met him is when he was in his dark place as well. He was... I think he was on a lot of medication, you know, whether they be legal or not, and I think he was going through a real tough time. So it's lovely to see him, how he's come out the other end with all the well-documented problems he's had. But I mean, he's been doing motivational speaking now, hasn't he? You know, I mean, he was doing theatres in Los Angeles. He's lost all that weight. He's keeping healthy now, and it's nice when you see, you know, similar to my situation as we were talking about before, that you've seen where they've come from to where he is. It makes me feel dead chuffed for him, because he's one of my heroes. He'll always be all of our heroes anyways. But I mean, he's still, and to see him in the shape he's in is unbelievable. But he's still 53. You know what I mean? I made my comeback at 36. God, Mike's, you know, stick another decade on. It's gone another couple of decades or more, you know, for Mike to do it. And I realised in my comeback fight that my best days had gone. So if I'm feeling at 36, I have no doubt, as well as he's looking for a 53-year-old, he's still 53. And I think Roy Jones Jr. is considerably younger than him. Very legend of the sport as well. Very, very, you know, a lot younger, very talented, speed. And I think it was only up to a couple of years ago he actually had his last competitive fight. So just as a pure hero, which they both are, but from Mike's point of view, being the older man and that, you know, I can't help but feel it can end in tears a little bit. And I certainly hope I'm wrong. Because, I mean, they're saying it's going to be an exhibition, which means, you know, which means like a little bit of a spar in front of a crowd. So, you know, what is Mike's mentality? And you can't teach what Mike's got, because I was very similar. When I went there, I wanted to hurt my opponents. You know what I mean? And Mike has the same mentality. So how can you go in there in front of thousands of people and just take it easy, Mike? The minute he gets picked off with a few jabs, Mike's going to want to go back to the old Mike. I might be wrong here, and I certainly hope I am, but I just think it could end in tears. And, you know, the last thing, you never lose your punch as you get older. One thing you do, you lose your resistance to a punch. And I'd like to see Mike, you know, or Roy get hurt, you know, after the legends, the career that they've had and the fights that they've been in, and they're both heroes of mine. I'd just rather not see it, if that's only my opinion.
Talking about two fighters who are a little younger, well, a lot younger, I guess, Tyson Fury, Anthony Joshua, what's the chances of them actually getting in a ring together?
I think there's a good chance, because I think that is a fight that has to happen, you know, for the sake of British boxing. You've got Tyson Fury, the undefeated lineal world champion, if you like. Anthony's won all his belts back. Do you know what I mean? We've got the two best heavyweights in the world. And I tell you what, it was only a few years ago, we couldn't name two British heavyweights. Now we've got the two best heavyweights on the planet. And the lockdown, it's a shame, couldn't have come at such a worse time, to be honest with you, you know what I mean? So, because everything's up in the air about not just this particular fight, but fights everywhere in general. It really is tough times, but I think it's got to happen. And I think it's a fight that is that big. I think it must happen. And I think the promoters, whether, AJ's promoter, Eddie Hearn, and Tyson's promoter, Frank Warren, and the TV networks, and BT and Sky, I think they've all got to be realistic and, you know, sit down together and say, listen, let's, you know, because that's the thing is we're promoting, isn't it? You know, that one, so everyone wants the lion's share of the pie, don't they? But I think they've got to turn around and say, here's what it is. There's enough money for it to all go around here. You know, let's all just be sensible. We'll have that, you have that, and let's get this fight on, you know, for the fans. And sometimes it doesn't happen, but I've got a confident feeling about this. I've got a confident feeling about this. I think to themselves, I think that the promoters and the TV company are just the people that are basically involved in it. I think they're going to leave their head on the chopping board if this, for some reason, this fight doesn't happen. I think fans will want to know why. And I think they deserve to ask, they'd be right to ask why.
And if it comes down to greed, do you think that's a shame for boxing?
I think it's absolutely crying shame, to be honest with you. I mean, ultimately, I'm Ben and Rock, so you want the best deal and the most money you can have, but you've got to look at the position. AJ's got all his belts back. Tyson's undefeated. The lineal champion is beat Wilder. If anything, I probably should say, you know, Tyson probably should get the lion's share because of his past victory and, you know, and he's undefeated and stuff like that. But yeah, but it's, you know, two champions that we're both proud of.
Absolutely. It couldn't be. I mean, in many sports, the UK probably not excelling at the moment. Heavyweight boxing is one where we certainly are, and it should be, you know, heralded, I guess.
Yeah, and it's not just for the sports. I mean, to be honest with you, you know, I mean, what do you do when British kids see, you know, Tyson Fury world champion and AJ world champion or Cal Flock world champion? More kids want to go in the gym because they want to be Anthony Joshua, they want to be Cal Flott, they want to be Tyson Fury. Do you know what I mean? And that's what it is. So you've got to look at it, you know, to have a fight of that stature where the country is going to be mesmerised by the whole occasion. It's not just about, you know, that fight and who earns the most money. It has bigger knock-on effects to our sport in general. Do you know what I mean?
And our economy, as you pointed out.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I asked you something about, obviously, you know, Billy Graham played a fundamental part in your development as a boxer. You beating Tzu, I can't say his name properly there. But after that Mayweather fight, you sort of parted, didn't you? Is that right? Close to that?
Yeah.
Was that, what was the reason for that? Was that because the towel came in, because you just thought it was time to move on?
Well, not at all, to be honest with you. The me and Billy Graham was... Billy Graham, before Ricky Hatton came along, I mentioned earlier in the interview, Ross, that, you know, he had so many champions in his camp. You know, Kyle Thompson was a world champion, Anthony Bingham was a British champion, Paul Burt was a Commonwealth champion. Before Ricky Hatton came along, he was a trainer of multiple champions anyway. And because he'd been doing it for a number of years, he used to do it on the body belt. If you remember the big body belt he used to put on round his body, where I used to do the majority of my training. But over the years, because he trained that many champions, that many big punches, it started having injuries with his hands, where he had to, and his elbows, where he had to have injections in his elbows to numb the pain so he could get through training sessions. And there were some days where I'd come in the gym and I'd say, "Oh, are we doing 8 rounds on the body belt?" And he'd say, "Oh, I can't today, Rick. You're going to have to just hit the bag," or something like that. And I thought to myself, and it wasn't Billy's fault, it's just father time, you know what I mean? He's, you know, just father time had just caught up with him and everything. And, you know, I said to Billy, you know, if I'm going to continue after this Mayweather defeat and continue to have another fight to carry on with my career, I need you at your best. And unfortunately, I think them days might be behind you, because, you know, you know, if you're having needles in your hands and elbows, you know, and I had a fight at the City of Manchester Stadium against Juan Lescano, and it wasn't really my best performance. You know, I won, but it wasn't really my best performance. And everyone was starting to ask for me to retire. You know, maybe I'd seen better days. And I said, if I'm going to give you one last go, Billy, I need somebody that's going to give me 100%. And unfortunately, you know, your body's just packed in on you now, mate. So we parted company, and he didn't agree with me. You know what I mean? So that's initially what we fell out. And there was another reason why we did fell out, but that was nothing to do with, we're friends now, me and Billy. We speak on the phone all the time. He comes to the gym every now and again, and we realised that, you know, the main reason that we fell out was nothing to do with us. It was due to do with a third party, you know. So I've moved on with that from Billy, and, you know, and everyone, the whole team, the former team, we're all in a nice place now. We're all friends again, and it's brilliant. But yeah, I want to look for another trainer if Billy Graham was, you know, fit and healthy and injury free and stuff like that. He was the best trainer I worked with by a country mile, and I'd have been with him till the finish if it was in my best interest. But his injuries were just, he wasn't been able to perform like he used to do all back in the day, you know.
Was it with hindsight, and hindsight's a wonderful thing, the right thing then to go to Floyd Mayweather Senior? What made you make that decision?
Well, I was without a trainer, and I went with my girlfriend at the time to Las Vegas just for a holiday. And a friend of mine out there, Lee Beard, who's a boxing coach in around the Manchester area, and says he was mates with Floyd Mayweather and does a bit of work with Floyd Senior. And he said, "Why don't you come to the gym and have a look? But, you know, see what you think of Floyd. You know, you don't have to say anything or do anything. Just come and speak to him, watch him train, just see what you think." So I went to the gym, saw him train, listened to some of the things he was saying and the advice he was giving and that. And I thought to myself, well, you know, I'm pretty set in my ways there, but there's one thing that's always let me down is a little bit of my defensive work and everything like that. And, you know, the Mayweather, Floyd Senior or the Mayweathers in general, they were known for the defence. And I thought, maybe I can pick up a few little things. You know, you're not going to change. We can't alter the goalposts. You know, my style is set in stone pretty much now. But maybe, you know, he'll get me in shape. He's got a lot of experience. He can teach me a few little moves from a defensive point of view. Maybe it was, you know, so I went with him. And me fight against Paulie Malignaggi, my next one, was probably one of my best performances since I beat Kostyuzou. You know, and I was probably right in order. So everything looked on the surface, looked good. And then I went with, then the fight came against Manny Pacquiao to challenge for the pound-for-pound title once again. And I think Floyd, I think he just went a little bit giddy. I think he was a little bit of an old-school type trainer, you know, when I was with Billy, and I'd done so many 12-rounders with Billy over the years, I could practically do it with my eyes shut. But Billy was a trainer of train hard one day, then have a day easy. Then train hard, then an easy day. Hard, easy. So you push your body to the limit, and then you let it recover. Push your body. Well, Floyd was a little bit different. You know, I did an extra 4 weeks with him for the Pacquiao fight. Then he did the Malignaggi fight. And I think he overtrained me a little bit, you know, a little bit old school, you know, just sparring Monday, sparring Wednesday, sparring Thursday, sparring Friday. And I'm saying, I feel shit, I feel crap here now, Floyd. Well, no, I think I need a bit of a rest, mate. I've trained for that many 12-rounders. I think I need a bit of a rest there, mate. No, I know what I'm doing. 12 rounds again. And I think looking back, I wish I'd opened my mouth and said, listen, Floyd, I'm experienced enough. You're killing me here. I need a rest. And
I'm no expert now, but it's considered wisdom now that you wave train in any sport, that you do go hard, but then you have a day off in order to go better the next day, and then you have a layoff. You still train, but you don't go balls to the wall, right? Every day.
Absolutely.
Because eventually you're gonna burn out.
Yeah, and I think that's a good trainer. He's gotta know when to put his foot down with you. And when he knows when to need a little bit, and I'm not calling Floyd because I mean he taught me a lot of so many good training methods and so many different things that I still use in my training today. Do you know what I mean? You know, wonderful, wealth full of knowledge. I mean, look what he did to his son. You know what I mean? So, you know, I mean, absolute wealth of knowledge, and I still use some of his training. But I think the one thing that let me down with Floyd Senior was there was no fast forward. And I think I speak not just for boxing, but I speak for any athlete here, whether you're a runner, a sprinter, a tennis player, a boxer, a footballer. You can't put your foot down non-stop and just leave it there. You know, some days, you know, you've got to have a day off. Some days you've got to, you know, knock it, taper it down a little bit. And Floyd didn't have that in his vocabulary training-wise. So, but...
Tell a story that you went in before the fight with like a flyweight, lightweight, just to speak your hands up, and he caught you.
Yeah. Well, I was sparring with the same guys for about a month out from the fight, and I was beating them up. And then, you know, once it got to like 2 weeks before the fight, where I was saying my last hard week of a training camp, all of a sudden I wasn't finding the target that quite good enough, and they were only lightweight, so they were pinging me, and my head was flying back here, and I was like. And then I threw one where I was a little bit more off balance than anything. But boom, he clipped me and I went down. And I went, oh, and then Floyd Mayweather, run, stop the spar, right, Rick, come on, jump out, have a rest. And I sat on the apron and I had my towel over my head. And I was crying. And this is like about 9 days out before the Pacquiao fight. My dad said, what's up, Rick? Ricky, you okay? You all right? I went, just leave me a minute, Dad, I'll be all right. And that was, and I knew from that moment that I'd peaked too soon. And, you know, so it sounds like I'm making excuses for the initial outcome, because, I mean, at the end of Pacquiao was bombing out everyone at the time. So, but, you know, was I at my best when I got in there? I don't think I was. I think I left it in the gym about a fortnight earlier.
Is that one of the biggest threats?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I thought to myself, I'm knowledgeable enough. I've been in this game long enough now. And it doesn't mean if I pulled Floyd and say, no, I don't care, I want to rest there now. I would have been being disrespectful. Because I'm knowledge enough myself in my own right. I think I should have just said, listen, Floyd, I need a rest here. I'm burnt out. I tell you what, you need to give me a rest here. And if I have about 4 or 5 days off, I might get it back then. But if I keep the way it's going, it's only going to go one way. It's going to go worse. And that's one thing. If I could turn the clock back, I wish I'd I wish I'd have done that. But like I say, hindsight is such a good thing, you know. And
lovely.
It's not in the boxer's nature to turn around and go, oh, I need a rest. I don't want to work out. And please, I need a rest. Because what do you do? We're boxers. We think, no, I'll go through it. I'll be all right. And I just wish I'd have opened my mouth here.
Did you miss Billy at that point? Not necessarily from a coaching point of view, but just from part of the coaching is not just the boxing, it's what goes on up here, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And Billy was my best mate, and thankfully to say he still is now to this day. But yeah, it was closer than wasn't just a boxer trainer relationship. We were best mates. We did everything together. You know what I mean? And when I was in the corner with him, and things were going bad. You know what I mean? Like sometimes you can't look like you can't look like Sugar Ray Robinson every fight. You know what I mean? Some days it's going to go a little bit bad, and you're not quite getting it off. And Billy could see that in the corner. When he was giving me advice, you know, I knew when I looked in his eyes, you know, he was there for me. He was throwing every punch for me. You know what I mean? He wasn't just there for the paycheck. Like, you know, he was there because he loved me, and he was giving me the best advice. So when I looked in his eyes and he looked in my eyes, there was that, not sounding soppy, there was that closeness, there was that love, you know, that he was, you know, wasn't just giving you advice just because, you know, so we can get the win and get the paycheck. He was giving the advice for your health and your safety and to win the fight and nothing else. And that's when it was never, whoever was going to go through, you can't just blame it on Floyd. If it had gone with Floyd, if it had gone with Buddy McGirt, if it had gone with Freddie Roach, you know, it had never been the same as it was with me and Billy. And that's not being disrespectful to them. It's just that me and Billy were just like that.
Well, also, it's a relationship that had developed since basically a young man, a kid, basically.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Well, my first night working with Billy, I was 16. You know what I mean?
People often talk about, Ricky, they talk about, those two famous fights, which were the two losses, Mayweather and Pacquiao. We're sort of forgetting that you had 45 victories, most of which you dispatched people often with body blows to the side, which is not often the way that people are knocked out. It takes an incredible amount of timing and energy and positioning to be able to expose a professional opposition to take that kind of punch and to put them down on the canvas. Do you often concentrate too much on those two losses rather than on the other victories, the overwhelming 45 victories?
Yeah, well, to be honest with you, we didn't know, but as it's panned out now, we're probably going to go down as two of the greatest fighters in history. You know what I mean?
So, oh, yeah, pound for pound. Yeah.
So, but I mean, I was very. They were number one pound for pound fighter in the world when I fought them. Mayweather was number one pound for pound best fighter in any weight division, any weight in boxing. Pacquiao was the same. But you know, I also beat people like when I won my first major world title, when I won the IBF title against Kostya Zou in Manchester. And nobody gave me a chance against Kostya Zou. Kostya Zou was number two pound for pound in the world, you know. So I was able to make Kostya Zou quit on his stool. Somebody who had was just knocking out everyone for fun, but, you know, in former world champions like Shambe Mitchell, three rounds, Zab Judah, two rounds, and then all of a sudden, you know, I'm walking through the punches he was bombing everybody out with, and ultimately he sat on his stool and went, no more, leave me alone, you know. So to be a champion that formidable, because it will probably be one of the greatest light welterweights of all time, Kostya Zou. He really was.
That fight is widely recognised as the best performance of any British boxer in the last 25 years.
Absolutely, and I take that as a massive compliment in the sense that, you know, everyone talks about them, there were fights even bigger than that one. Do you know what I mean? It really is pinch yourself type stuff. But it was, that was like the day where I achieved my goal. I'd won the WBU world title before that, but that was considered not a major recognised governing body. But the IBF and Kostya Zou was considered the number one in the weight division, the undisputed champion, number two pound for pound. Nobody gave me a chance to beat him. Those were the days that when I was a 16-year-old, when I first got to meet Billy, we would sit on the steps of the gym in Salford, and Billy would have a cigarette, and I'd sit there with a cup of tea, and we'd talk about all the great fights and all the great champions of old, and all the, you know, we'd talk about Madison Square Garden and Las Vegas, and not just beating some of the best fighters in the world, but being the best fighter in your weight division. And that was the day when I beat the best man in my weight division, number two pound for pound. That was the day where I fulfilled my dream of when I said I was going to be the best in my weight division. That's when it came true, that dream. And to do it in my hometown of Manchester, 22,000 people, you know what I mean? You know, and he said it would be one of the greatest wins ever in a British boxing ring, you know what I mean? It was such a time for Manchester. It brought so much revenue to the city. And people talk about, you know, with what Man United's done and what Manchester City's done, and they won the Premiership and Champions League and European Cups and all that. For that still to be recognised as one of the greatest sporting event of days in the city of Manchester, I think that speaks for volumes as well for just how formidable a fighter I beat that night.
Well, there are incredible highs in your game when you reach the ultimate level, which you have, but there are also incredible lows as well, aren't there? Yeah. And as I say, defeat is maybe more public in boxing than any other profession, I think, any other sporting profession. How did that self-belief suddenly is whittled away or knocked, how difficult is it to come back from that?
It's very difficult, and people have their own reasons why they was able to get back on track. You know, I watched a brilliant thing on Life Stories with Vinnie Jones the other day. It was really emotional and really, you know, it was really good. And what he said, what normally turns it around is either, you know, a relationship or your kid or a baby comes along or something like that that triggers you to get you back on the straight and narrow. And for me, it was when my second baby came along, Millie. She was born when I was in the height of my depression. I was going through a really bad time. I was drinking massive, very, very heavily. I'd got into drugs. I was suicidal. I was depressed, tried to kill myself several times. And it was a real, real bad time of it. I fell out with Billy Graham, as we touched on a little bit earlier. I also fell out with my mum and dad, you know, at the time. So it was like, you know, one minute, you know, I'm on the top of the world, then I get beat by Mayweather, then I fell out with Billy, then I beat Malignaggi, so I was back up. And then I fought with my mum and dad, then I was back down, and then I got beat by Pacquiao, so I was down again, and my frame of mind was going up and down, up and down, up and down. And then ultimately, when I fell out with my mum and dad, I didn't care whether I lived or died, and it was a real, I'd tell you what, you know, a real, for where I feel very proud for where I am present day, from how bad it really was. It was shocking. But the only thing that got it was when Millie was born, and I thought to myself, listen, Ricky, you know, you've got Campbell, your lad, who's a little bit older now. What I said, it's not about you anymore. It's about your kids. Do you know what I mean? You've worked so hard to get where you've got, and you're going to throw it all away. You're going to throw your kids away. You're going to throw your family away. You're going to throw your life away, you know, and you've worked so hard to get where you've got. And then Millie come along. So I started getting myself together a little bit. And even when Millie came along, I couldn't get it together. I was still struggling, you know, with the drink and the drugs and the depression and feeling down. So I went and saw a psychiatrist who I still see to this day, if I need to, you know what I mean? But proud to say I haven't seen him for a couple of years now. That's how well I'm doing. But I do know he's on speed dial. But that's what I did. I went up, I said, I'm really struggling here. I went on my knees and I just said, I'm going to end up killing myself here. I can't do it on my own. Can you please help me and tell me what I need to do to get myself back on track, because I've got everything now. I've got a little girl coming along. I've got everything to go and I'm struggling. I went with him for treatment bit by bit, and he told me how I can cope and deal with it to get myself in a positive mood. And where I am today, it's great. I'm an ambassador now for mental health with the Frank Bruno Foundation. I work with Frank for the Frank Bruno Foundation. And it's very, very hard because when I knew I had it, I didn't want to come out and say it at first, Ross, because I was scared. I thought people might have thought me, well, I was a nutter or something, you know. So, well, I think the more people that we can get that come out and say and discuss the problems, I think, you know, the better people with mental health will be. And that's what I did. I just knew I couldn't do it no more. I said, someone help me, please, because I can't do it on my own. And I think that's half the battle done with this thing we call mental health. And that's what got me out of my ruck.
But there is in other sports, there's a professional football players association. There are places where people can go. When you think about the money that is turned over in the boxing game, do you not think that possibly a percentage of that could be put away to help fighters maybe in later life, you know, particularly if they develop any kind of health problem, but maybe mental health problems, but also physical problems.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a conversation that's been going up for years, to be honest with you, and it never seems to make any further progress, to be honest with you. You know, it's like, and it's not just, you know, boxers, we don't come from Cambridge and Oxford. We come from council estates, and, you know, we come off the council estates, and 9 times out of 10, if these boxers have got, a money through their ability of what they've done through the boxing, 9 times out of 10, they don't know how to look after the money.
You know, more successful generally anyone becomes, the more of a entourage they have around them, but they all cost, right?
Yeah, boxers don't know how to cope with, if they're very fortunate enough to get through a vast amount of money, they don't know how to cope, you know, because we've boxed all our life. We come from the council estates, all of a sudden, you end up being a world champion and you get this. So I was very fortunate that I had good people around me to advise me. But 9 times out of 10, and how many times, Ross, do we see these stories of former world champions ending up with no money? So, you know, they need something in place to help them in that area. And then also with the mental health side of things, because sometimes it's forgotten, really. You know, in boxing, it's like, you know, yeah, we've had the champion, all right, he's won and he's retired now, let's move on to the next prospect. And, you know, sometimes I think we're all guilty, you know, of, you know, not having something in place, like a professional footballers association, you know, a professional boxers association, just so boxers, because 9 times out of 10, they haven't got a football club behind them, you know, in order to help them and guide them and advise them. It's, you know, they're on their own.
The agent's taking his percentage and he's now on to the next best thing, as you say, yeah?
Exactly. And it's a shame. And, you know, this raises its head so up. You won't believe how often this raises its head. And I think it's down to, maybe promoters or, you know, should say, listen, you know, from every, you know, we're going to chuck a summit in a pot, you know, to try and get this thing going, you know, because, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, they've made the money for you, you know, so you look after them after they've gone, you know.
Would make sense to me, but maybe not to the people that make the biggest slice. I mean, you know, what about that? I mean, it's two questions for you I have to ask. We know that people are able now to run faster than they've ever run before. People are rowing quicker. Are people punching harder now? Is sports science affecting the way people box, or is it always just been the toughest sport there is?
No, I think you know, you from a boxing point of view, I think you're blessed with natural punching power, but you know, punching power can be developed, you know, I mean, in the sense, you know, from a technical point of view, you know, I wasn't the biggest puncher in the world, but, you know, I punched with all of my body. You know what I mean? I used to punch with leverages, you know, instead of throwing, a right uppercut. Billy Graham would say, you know, before you throw the uppercut, put a little dip on it, you know, just that, to get that little bit of extra bite. You know, instead of throwing your left up, turn your shoulder, you know, to get that extra little bit. And there's certain training methods you can do now where there's, you know, years ago, the best gyms were like in the days of Rocky, when, you know, you used to be chasing chickens, and having raw eggs and all that. Them days are gone now. And I know some people do like the spit and sawdust gyms, but I think, you know, if you've got on your doorstep, you know, like you see some of these health and fitness towns with the resistance work and the weights you can have, you know, and some of the apparatus that they can have on in these gyms. I think, you know, if Sugar Ray Robinson had them, you know, all them years ago, you're not telling me he wanted it that even harder and been a better boxer and, a better engine. Sometimes you just got to move with the times, you know what I mean? Sometimes, you know, if you've got, you know, you're at the very, very top level and you're evenly matched with your opponent, say me and Crusty Zoo or something like that, sometimes it can be, the difference nowadays can be the difference with having that little bit extra nutritional advice, that little bit of extra, you know, weights to throw about, a little bit of extra machines where you can get that little bit of resistance about, then machines that you can go on where it takes you to failure, you know what I mean, where it takes you to the limit. If you've got them, if you're in a spit and sawdust and all you've got is a punch bag and a speedball, it doesn't need me to tell you, you know, who's going to get the best out of the training these days, and that's the way it is. You've just got to move with the times.
Yeah, there are also a lot of sons of very famous boxers now that are doing quite well. Costa Zoo's son, I saw, won a fight not long ago. Your Chris Eubank's son, Your son, Campbell.
Campbell.
Well, how do you feel about him going into a sport that has obviously given you so much, but it's also cost you in way?
Well, to be honest, I never wanted him to go into boxing, to be honest with you. My whole purpose of going into boxing was to go into it so you don't have to. Do you know what I mean? So, but he wanted to do it off his own back. He's watched the videos for years. He's watched the videos of his dad. He's watched the videos of his uncle, Matt, you know, and all the Manchester fighters who he's been very, very fortunate to meet from a very, very young age growing up. And then he's just something he really took a natural fancy to. He went in the gym, you know what I mean? He started training, and then he started doing a little bit of training with me here and there. And he absolutely loves the game, and he's absolutely devastated. And I don't want to speak get too far ahead, because it's still early days. I mean, he hasn't even turned professional yet. But he might have it, to be honest with you. You know, he's got that, you know, he fights like me. He's got that, you know, self-belief, dedicated. You're probably more dedicated than I was at his age of 19, if the truth be known. But I think he might half have it. I've just got to, you know, let him carry on the way he's going, let him keep training, let him develop and that. But I think it won't be long before he visits the professional ranks, and I think he'll do well. You know, he's got a lot of pressure on his shoulders, you know, with what I achieved, you know, but he carries it well, and you know what I mean, and he doesn't look at that. He just says to me, "Dad, if I go pro one day," I said, I'll make it off my own back. I don't need you," which is.
That shows a bit of self belief, then, a bit of hat and self belief.
That's exactly what it is. He's not being nasty when he says it, but that's what I want to hear. So it's just a case of watch this space he's got. He's got a great personality. He's got, you know, he's got a one-liner for everyone. You know, you take the mickey out, you won't even know he's doing it. He's one of them, but he's exciting to watch, exciting style, dead aggressive. And if he does go pro, I think they'll love him. And I don't want to put any pressure on him, but I think he might have half a chance. It's exciting times.
When you see him up in the ring, do you worry about him more than you ever worried about yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, when you're in the ring, as nervous as you are, you could do something about it. But when you've got your family member or your loved one in the ring, you know, you can't help him there. It's like we talked about earlier, you know what I mean? They put the gum shield in, you know, you haven't got 11 teammates. You've got to do it on your own. And it doesn't matter what I tell him in the gym. He's got to go out there and do it once that bell goes. It's very, very hard. But I train him now, along with my brother, Matthew. And I feel a little bit easier now, because now, you know, Matthew said, "Will you train me?" And we and Matthew trained me, and we've said, "Yeah, I've got a job to do now, so I can't afford to be as nervous as I was when I was just his dad, when he was, you know, training and just, you know, sat at ringside watching my son box. It was absolutely horrible. But now I know I've got a job to do. I find I'm coping a little bit better with it, because, I mean, you know, I've got a job to do. Even though I'm nervous, I can't let him down. You know what I mean? We've got it, you know. And so I'm doing the job now, training him. I never thought I would be able to train him a few years ago, because it was absolutely horrible watching him fight. I was sick every time. He had to run to the toilets, throw up before the fight, Ross, and then come out and then put a brave face on him. Go on, Campbell, you know. But now I'm training him, and I know I've got a job to do, and he's got to get the best from his dad. I find I'm coping with it a little bit better, yeah.
The hard one. If you went back to the heyday when you were at your best professionally, how would you gone about beating yourself?
I would have gone about beating myself. I'd have probably thrown a load of body shots trying to open up that beer gut that was in behind behind that little six pack. But no, I don't know. I think I'd have probably I probably counter-punched myself, because even though I was aggressive, I was an aggressive counter-puncher, where I would put me pressure on my opponents, but I would let them make the first move. I'd march the ring down, I'd feint to them, let them make the first move, and then I would slip in and throw a body shot or a left hook or whatever. And if I remember the fight, apart from the Mayweather fight, which obviously Mayweather's Mayweather, but I remember a fight back in my early career when I fought a guy called Eamon McGee from Ireland for the WBA.
Yeah, I saw some of that. That was brutal.
He was a southpaw and he was a counter puncher. And what he did, I'd be marching him down to the ropes and he'd go to the ropes and I'd be fighting, go on, punch, so I can move in on you. And he wouldn't throw nothing. So I'd end up thinking, well, come on, throw something. And then he thought, well, he's not throwing something. Then I'd lead to him and he'd counter me. So it was, you know, the best way to beat a counter-puncher is to counter-puncher, because what is a counter-puncher? He's waiting for you to throw first. So when I was waiting for them to throw first, then all of a sudden I got an opponent that was waiting for me to throw first. And it was the first time I had to deal with it in my career, and he knocked me down in the first round. Bit of a flash knockdown, and then I thought, oh, right. And then I tried to put it on him, and he hurt me with one in the second round, shut me up with one. It was worse than the knockdown. And I come back to the corner, and Billy turned around and said, listen, you've got to show a little bit more patience here. He's waiting to counterpunch you. He's trying to beat you at your own game here. You've got to show more patience. And that's what I did in the end. But I think that's how I'd beat Ricky out, and his counter punching. Don't lead to him. If you lead to him, I'm going to get to you. If you lead to me, I'm going to get to your ribs, aren't I? You know. So he was just dead tight, and he waited for me to do the leading. And I think that's the way you beat Ricky out. But I'm retired now, so tough shit, everyone.
Okay, here's a serious one for you. Who's been your biggest enemy?
My biggest enemy. I would say me in my boxing game. Eamon McGee was my biggest enemy because he was a bit mouthy, he was a bit nasty with it. Eamon McGee, he knocked me down twice. He said, "Oh, you're just a kid, you are not." And I hated him. But then he become my friends now. You know, whenever I go to Ireland, I'll have a pint of Guinness with him, and that he come in the changing room before a box cost you zoo and said, "Come on, Ricky, don't listen to these. You can do it, mate." You know, and I thought I hated you a few years ago. But that's boxing for you. That's the type of sport it is. Once you've been in the ring and you've shared blood with each other, you know what I mean? It's the respect is always there. So I say from a boxing point of view, he was my enemy. But I think my worst enemy was myself, you know, because I what went on in between my ears sometimes, you know, we've discussed about my mental health and stuff like that, you know, which was amazing because earlier on in my career, I had such unbelievable self-belief. But then when I got beat by Mayweather, my confidence was nuts because I didn't just go there going, you know, for my biggest payday and, you know, and I'm grateful to Floyd Mayweather. I went thinking I was going to beat him. And then when I didn't, you know, it was very hard to come back and I had to cancel all my functions. I didn't want to show my face. When I was walking down the street, I thought people were laughing at me. This is in my hometown. I thought people were laughing at me and that's what I'd got in my head. You know, I was down after the Mayweather fight, down after the Scarno fight, then fell out with Billy, so I was proper down. Then I performed well against Malignaggi, I was back up. Then I got beat by Pacquiao, I was back down. And then I got beat by Pacquiao, I had to retire. Then I fell out with my mum and dad, you know. So, you know, what was, you know, people didn't realise it. There was that story in the paper of me one time when, you know, where everyone thought I was a bit of a hypocrite when I was found taking drugs in the paper. But that was right in the thick of all these things going wrong and up and down and up and up and down. I didn't know who I was with, what I wanted to do, or just what I just wanted to kill myself. And very, very tough times. And I'd still, through them things, I think I still have it today. Not as bad as what it, you know, I'm tenfold past back them days now. I mean, I'm in such a place now, you know, where, you know, I know, you know, I can never turn the clock back to the world title wins and the 40,000 singing there's only one Ricky Hatton. But I mean, this is probably the happiest I've been now. And from where it's been, it's been a big test because, you know, that little one, I used to get that little man on my shoulder, Ross. Oh, you're the failure. Oh, you're this. Oh, you're that. Everyone's laughing at you, you know, and all that. It took me a while to get rid of him. And sometimes he pops back, but nowhere near as much as he used to.
Ricky Hatton, you are a living legend, sir. And you're a thoroughly decent human being. It's been an absolute honour to speak to you. And thank you so much.
My pleasure. Really enjoyed it, Ross. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Kempcast. If you haven't already, please subscribe, rate and review. You can find me on Twitter at Ross Kemp and on Instagram at Ross Kemp TV. This has been a Freshwater at the chance of collective production. Thanks to the team and one fine play. And until the next episode, goodbye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.